Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you sacrifice to save a human life? While few of us would think twice about ruining an expensive new outfit to dive into a pond after a drowning toddler, many more of us go about our daily lives without much thought to the estimated 10 million children who, under the age of 5, who die every year of causes related to poverty. Well over 2 billion people of all ages subsist on less than $2 a day. So what keeps the affluent world from doing enough to relieve so much human suffering? Peter Singer has a not-so-radical solution to the problem, which he believes can be solved without sacrificing the quality of life many of us enjoy, even in tough economic times. He is Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and the new book that outlines his plan is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
What do you believe is required of ethical people in terms of poverty relief?
I think what's required is that we do something significant towards relieving poverty. That is, that we give a percentage of our income to agencies that we know to be effective in doing this. And the percentage is roughly something that would, if everybody were to do it, yield enough to solve, well, not to solve the problem completely, maybe that may not be possible, but at least to make substantial progress towards solving it.
One of the things that you think we really need to do is completely overhaul our sense of what it means to be a good and a moral person.
That's right. We have this sense that if you obey the various moral rules, the ones that usually begin with thou shalt not, that's enough to become to be a good, decent, moral person. I'm suggesting that it should also be an essential part of that, that we do something positive towards those who have very little, especially if we are in a situation where we have more than enough, if we're able to afford luxuries for ourselves, and if the cost of those luxuries would be enough to save lives elsewhere in the world, as in the example you mentioned of the cost of a pair of shoes, maybe, then that's something that we really ought to do, not just something that's nice to do, not just something that exemplary people do, but something that is required of us to share at least some of that abundance that we have with those in extreme poverty.
Why do you think, Peter, that so many codes of behavior that we have in cultures and societies all over the world seem to have an easier time stressing sins of commission as opposed to omission?
I think it's because that's a way to make morality more limited. It doesn't open this whole area of saying, well, what are the things that we're failing to do? What are our responsibilities that we're not fulfilling? It essentially just says, well, here are the rules. Don't do any of these things, and you'll be okay. And maybe, when we lived in small communities, that wasn't too bad. That did apply to most of our obligations. But now that we're part of a world that is global, that's interconnected, that we can make a difference to the lives of people and other on the other side of the world, I think that's changed. I think we have new obligations just because of our new capacities to make a difference to people so far away from us.
Can you talk for a minute about the difference between extreme poverty as it's experienced in this country as opposed to in the developing world?
Sure. Well, when I talk about extreme poverty in the developing world, I use the World Bank's definition, which means that these are people who don't have enough income to meet their basic needs for food, shelter, maybe some education for their children or some minimal health care. And the World Bank says that people living on the purchasing power equivalent of $1.25 US per day, people living on less than that, are extremely poor. So that's, with the purchasing power equivalent means that it's less than what you could buy for their currency, the same sort of things that you can buy in this country for $1.25 a day. So it's not even the cash equivalent if you go to a bank in that country and turn your $1.25 into the local currency, because often then you get more purchasing power. But this takes that difference in purchasing power into account. So it's a very small amount of money. If we compare that with people who are poor in this country, most of the poor in this country still have a television set, for example, which would be beyond the dreams of those in extreme poverty. Really, all of the poor in this country have safe drinking water. The cities all here have safe drinking water. If you're really poor in a developing country, you might have to walk for an hour to a river just to get water for your family, and then you have to carry a container of that water back again. And even when you've done it, it isn't safe. You really would have to boil it to make it safe, and to do that, you may have to go around, gather firewood from a wide area. Firewood may be scarce, so you don't have safe drinking water. You don't, you know, here the poor, if their child gets diarrhea, say, and you take them to an emergency room, if they're really seriously ill, the emergency room is not going to turn you away. They're going to treat your child and save your child's life. If you're in extreme poverty, you don't have a health clinic or a hospital near you to do that, very likely. Or if you do, they may charge you something for it that you can't afford. The poor here can all send their children to school. Education is free. It's not always free in the developing world. And they may not be able to afford to send their children to school.
Do you get the sense that many Americans are sort of afraid to acknowledge those differences?
I think some Americans are afraid to acknowledge the differences. Some Americans may be genuinely ignorant about the rest of the world. I think the mainstream media do not really do a good job of telling Americans what the rest of the world is like. If there is some dramatic event, they may show some footage of a drought or a flood or a famine. There may be some footage there. But just the everyday life of a billion people in the world living in extreme poverty is not something that Americans really learn about from their media. So whether it's a combination of them being afraid to look at it or simply not really even having the opportunity to look at it properly, I'm not sure what it is, but certainly Americans very often don't really know what extreme poverty in the world is like.
How do you explain the difficulty that we have connecting on a human level with people who are suffering from poverty if we haven't met them and seen them in person?
The difference there is partly the fact that we relate to people we do meet, or sometimes perhaps to people we see on television and we hear about, but we relate to identifiable individuals, to a particular person. We don't relate that much to the statistical, the numbers, the number of children that are dying of starving or dying of simple diseases like diarrhea, 2 million a year, the World Health Organization tells us. We don't relate to that, and so we don't give to it. We don't give to those figures, if you like. We give to an individual child in need that we see, and we need to think of the world's poor as individuals, as having faces too.
One of the things you've done, Peter, is devise a formula for Americans according to their incomes. Can you talk a little bit about how it's structured?
Yes, this is what I was talking about at the top of the interview when I said I think we need to give a percentage of our income calculated to be enough or more than enough so that if most people gave this, we could make big inroads into poverty. So by my calculations, this doesn't have to be very much. For 90% of Americans, I'm suggesting giving 1% of your income a year. So if you're on $50,000, which is the median American income, that would mean $500 a year. And then if you are earning more than that, if you're earning enough to put yourself in the top 10% of American taxpayers, that means you're earning $105,000 a year or above. I suggest you rise to 5% of whatever you're earning over that level. And if you are in the top 5% of American taxpayers earning $148,000 and above, I suggest you go to 10% for what you earn above that level. And so it steps up gradually, and it reaches a maximum of one-third for people who are earning millions of dollars a year. But it never goes beyond that. So that's why I think it's a realistic scale. People who are earning millions can afford to give a third of their income. They still have a lot of money left. People earning $100,000 can probably afford to give something like 5%, many of them. People earning $50,000 or $80,000, many of them can probably afford to give 1%. So I think it's a realistic scale, but when you add it all up, it adds up to a lot of money, more than the best estimates of what it would take us to really, let's say, halve the proportion of the world's people living in extreme poverty.
And without a great deal of material sacrifice on the people who would do this at 1% or even 5%.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the sacrifices are, you know, larger in monetary terms for those who have more, of course, but they can spare that better. And, you know, there may be people in the present economic downturn who feel they can't even give 1% because they're struggling to meet their rent or their mortgage. And I would say, you know, fine, wait until you're in a better place financially. I hope you'll think about this again and you'll be able to do it. But for most people, 1% is not unreasonable. In fact, the average American does give more than 1%, on average about 2% of their income to some sort of charity. But I am talking about focusing on giving priority to those in extreme poverty, where so many people die unnecessarily from poverty, and others just are not able to live the kind of life that we think really human beings are entitled to live.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because there are people who are making charitable contributions at the levels that you talk about, but they choose other kinds of causes, funding for the arts and things like that. You see those choices as, and these are your words, morally dubious. Can you talk about why?
Right, because I feel that the situation the world is in with, you know, that UNICEF figure of 10 million children dying every year from poverty-related causes, that comes down to 27,000 children dying every day. We felt that September 11th, 2001, was a black day. 3,000 people died on that day. Imagine nine times that many people dying. And that's only the children under five. There are, of course, adults dying as well that we should be concerned about. So it's an emergency. We've got a football stadium full of people dying unnecessarily every day. And I think under those circumstances, to say, well, I'm a charitable person, I've given a lot of money to my city's symphony orchestra or to the art museum, I think that is not really fulfilling your obligations to do something about this situation. It's not a good sense of priorities. If you want to do that, well, give the amounts I'm suggesting first to those organizations that are effectively and sustainably helping people to get out of poverty. And then if you have more to give and you want to give to culture and the arts, well, okay, I'm not going to criticize you for doing that then. But I do think we should at least be doing the minimum to try to deal with this enormous problem of extreme poverty and the consequences of it.
So a lot of people are aware that there is U.S. federal aid sent to developing countries and assume because of that that we're sort of already doing our share, but it's drawn out of tax money. Can you talk about how that money is actually allocated and spent?
Right. Well, the first thing is that there's not nearly as much of it as a lot of Americans imagine. It's quite amusing. I quote statistics in the book that you ask Americans whether they think the government is spending too much, too little, or the right amount on foreign aid, and quite a few Americans say too much. So you then say, well, as a percentage of all federal government spending, how much do you think the federal government should be spending on foreign aid? And the answers in various surveys have ranged from people saying, oh, about 5% or around 10%. Now, the fact is the federal government spends less than 1% of its spending on foreign aid. So here you have people who are saying on the one hand, oh, I think we spend too much on foreign aid. And on the other hand, when you ask them to name what they think would be the right kind of figure to spend on foreign aid, they give you a figure that's 5 to 10 times as high as what we're actually spending. So clearly they don't have the facts, and they're not in a position really to judge whether we're spending enough or too much, whatever. And so the first job is to educate them about how little we actually do spend on foreign aid.
Peter Singer is my guest. He's professor of bioethics at Princeton University. His new book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. We'll return in a moment and welcome your calls to 1-800-933-5372 and your emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, Peter Singer. His newest book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org. Dollar for dollar, Peter, do you see a difference in the effectiveness of money spent by governments as opposed to private NGOs?
I do, yes, in many ways. One is that government aid tends to be politically skewed, so we give it to countries in which we have political interests. At the moment, Iraq is by far the country that receives the most U.S. foreign aid. But it's not really a very poor country, although clearly we've got some responsibility for its problems. But it's sitting on the world's third largest oil reserves, and it shouldn't really need as much aid as some of the much poorer countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, which are way down on the list. So that's one problem. The other problem is that a lot of U.S. aid is tied to providing U.S. manufactured products or services. So let me give you one example. Congress voted for a sizable sum of money for condoms to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS in Africa. That's a very good thing. But they also said the condoms had to be sourced from an American manufacturer. Now, U.S.-made condoms cost about twice as much as condoms made in various other countries in the world. So on the one hand, they're giving a lot of money. On the other hand, they're providing that money can only buy half as many condoms as it could if you just went out to the global marketplace and looked around for the best price you could get for condoms of the required quality.
So it was not a quality issue. This was definitely sort of condom trade protectiveness.
It was just an issue to protect, I think, a particular person of Congress wanted to protect a factory in his home district that was the condom manufacturer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Whitney in Wichita Falls. Hello, Whitney.
Hi. I tuned in late, so y'all may have kind of addressed this issue already. And I understand that his book is on the topic of world poverty. But when he used the term that it was like a moral obligation, I kind of feel like it's a moral obligation that we should take care of the poor and the dying children in our country. I get that other countries don't have the resources we do, and we should participate on a world scale and help others, but it just kind of seems like it's not even mentioned because there's many, many, many impoverished children in this country, starving, dying, diseases, all those kinds of things. So I'll take my answer off there, but I kind of wanted to see if he would address that.
Thanks for your call. Well, it did come up before, Whitney, but perhaps you can offer some additional thoughts, Peter, on that issue.
Yes, I can. I certainly agree with Whitney that we should be helping the poor in this country. We're a rich enough country to help our own poor and to do a lot more than we're doing for the poor in other countries as well. One of the things to remember, though, is that because of the enormous difference in our wealth and the poverty of poor countries, our dollars will often go a lot further in other countries. I give examples in the book. I give examples of this dreadful condition called obstetric fistula, which can happen to girls and young women who are more or less forced to get married too young before their bodies are ready to have babies. And then they get this injury during the labor process if things go wrong. And it can ruin their entire life. So you could have a 16-year-old girl and the rest of her life is going to be misery. Her husband will reject her because of this injury, which makes it very hard for her to keep herself clean, really impossible. Her family even can't really care for her. Now, that costs about $450 to repair. So for $450 given to a foundation that's combating fistula, you can give this young girl her life back. It's pretty hard to help a poor teenager in this country in such a dramatic way for $500 or some sum like that. That's why I think it is important to think about making our dollars go further, and very often that means looking elsewhere.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Denton and speak with Christopher. Hey, Christopher.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm more or less playing the devil's advocate here, but I was wondering your guest's position on in an economic system where when people stop buying cars that they don't need every year, just to have a newer car, what would happen if that 1% or 2% of everyone's income went out of the taxable, buying taxable goods and went into tax-exempt donations? Because when we spend, when we stop spending frivolously, our economic system goes into turmoil as it is right now, what would happen if, you know, if that happened?
Could this actually hurt our economy, Peter?
Well, I believe that if we bring other people in the world into the global economy, then as they prosper, they will want to buy things from us too. So, you know, yes, there will be a small reduction in domestic spending. I'm not sure whether that would be noticeable, but maybe it would be noticeable to some extent. But if we can succeed in empowering other people to become part of the global economy, our economy will grow again through that expansion. So there may be some ups and downs in this. I'm not saying it will exactly balance out. But I think that we can cope with that very marginal, perhaps, reduction in demand here. And in return, eventually, we will reap an economic benefit for it. Let me also point out, I think we will reap a benefit in having a more peaceful world, a world with perhaps fewer refugees causing problems because of poverty, perhaps less violence, perhaps fewer diseases starting in poor countries. So I think in the long run, we will be benefiting ourselves as well.
An email from Ben in Dallas says, many argue that those nations and societies are responsible for their own people, and we are more responsible for helping the people struggling here in our own neighborhoods. What do you say to those who argue that poverty in the rest of the world, no matter how gut-wrenching, is simply not our responsibility?
Well, I don't believe that the national boundaries are also boundaries of responsibility. Yes, I mean, I agree that there may be some countries where you feel the country is wealthy enough to look after their poor and they don't need aid from us. And perhaps, you know, those are countries we might not help. But there are other countries where even if their governments are genuinely trying to help the people of the country as a whole, they simply don't really have the resources that we have. Perhaps they don't have the technology and the know-how that we have either to help people in the country. The problems are just too overwhelming for them. And I think we have to accept that this is one world. We have to live up to that rhetoric that we talk about, that we think all human lives are of equal value. And we have to say we can help here. We can help, and we can help at a quite modest cost to ourselves, and therefore that's what we ought to do.
Do you imagine that this level of aid that you're proposing that we all undertake needs to be thought of as a permanent thing, or could we conceive a time in a decade or half a century when the amount of aid that we've provided has caused different societies to be fully self-sustainable?
I'm hoping that it will be something that will be phased out, not in a decade. I think the problem is bigger than that, but you said maybe half a century. And I think that's a possibility, that in half a century, if we really work at this, apply our intelligence, make aid smart and effective and sustainable, that in half a century we could get to a situation where it's become a much smaller problem and we don't need to put much resources into it. It's, you know, there would still be pockets of poverty, but not a billion people living in extreme poverty as we have now.
An email from Kathy asks, wouldn't birth control be more effective for ending world poverty?
Well, birth control is certainly something that we should make available to people and educate people about. It's not enough to end world poverty. Not all poverty is caused by overpopulation, but I quite agree that there are some countries where population is growing, countries that are poor, where that is a serious contribution to poverty. And in those countries, we do need to make sure that means of birth control are available, but that's not enough. We also need to provide education. People will use birth control more if they're educated, if they understand their situation. We need to make sure that they have that opportunity to educate their children. Particularly, we need to make sure that they can educate their girls, because that's one of the things that correlates most strongly, that if the more years of education, and I'm just talking about elementary school education, the more years a girl has, the fewer the number of children that she's likely to have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Peter Singer is my guest. His newest book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Let's speak next with Terry in Dallas. Hi, Terry.
Hello. Thank you, and it's a very good show. I have a comment and a question, and I'll get on with here. It's a small world, and our gated communities will not save us from the next disease that is going to come out of this 2 billion squalor. That's my comment.
Right.
Question has to do with missionary work. And please, I'm not being critical here. I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around this. Since the 1800s, many denominations, churches, many, have sent hundreds and millions of missionaries. And I'm going to use Africa as an example. And yet, I don't see that much progress. What's happening there? I'll get off the air and take my answer. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. It's a good point. I mean, we have tried. I don't think we've put enough aid in. I think despite the churches and the missionary work that they've done, it's still not really the kind of sustained push that I'm talking about. Plus, I would say I think we've got a little bit smarter about what works and what's effective. We have a number of organizations that are evaluating aid projects. We have a website you can go to called givewell.net. It does that, and I've also set up a website with the same address as the title of the book, thelifeyoucansave.com, that looks at organizations that I believe are effective. And I think, therefore, we can learn from the past, and we can start to help people more. And let me say, we are making progress. It's not as if we're back to where we were, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. The proportion of people in extreme poverty in the world has fallen dramatically over the last 30 or 40 years. Even the numbers have fallen in absolute terms, despite the growth in world population. There are fewer people in extreme poverty now than there were in the 1970s. So we are making progress, but it just, you know, would be great if we could make it a little faster, because each year that we don't make it, that's another 10 million children who've died from preventable causes.
What's the difference between efforts that provide short-term relief, food for hungry bellies and medicine for people who are critically ill, as opposed to those that seek to sort of remake entire political and economic cultures?
Well, I think sometimes you do have to provide food for hungry bellies. There's a drought or a civil war, and there are lots of refugees pushed off their land. You can't let them starve. You've got to feed them. But I favor aid which doesn't just feed people, but which helps them to feed themselves. And so we need to help them to grow more food, for example, by improving the seeds that they have, improving agricultural techniques, helping them to get fertilizer, all of those sorts of things. And then they can feed themselves. We can also work with structural change. We can help to improve transport so that they can sell things to nearby markets. And sometimes we can help to support better government, to support good governance. That's something that aid has attempted to do over the years with only mixed results, but we need to push for that. And let me say, while we're talking about structures, we could improve our own aid policies. People could contact their congresspeople and say, we don't want these wasteful agricultural subsidies. They cost us, the taxpayers, billions of dollars a year, and they harm developing countries because farmers growing these products in developing countries can't compete with the subsidized U.S. crops.
Let's go next to Jeff in Arlington. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Singer, I wanted to say thank you for your work and what you've done to help relieve the suffering in the world. And I was going to ask you what would be good organizations to donate to, but I think you've already answered that with your website. So let me ask this. What is something that a person can do if they are interested in helping relieve world suffering besides giving money? What can I do in my life that would make an impact? Of course, I want to donate some of my income to helping that, but since I don't have a pretty modest income myself, mm-hmm. What can I do besides money to help the situation? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. Well, just to comment on there, I mean, I think we can find organizations that we can volunteer for and help. And we can also start talking about this. I think people need to talk more about giving, maybe set up study groups or book groups maybe that talk about these issues. And on the website that I mentioned, thelifeyoucansave.com, you can pledge to give according to the formula that I mentioned before. And I think that will help to encourage other people to give. We've currently got about 1,700 people who've pledged to do that. And I think as the number grows, people will feel well, this is something that a lot of people are doing. I won't be isolated. And more people will be happy to be part of that.
We have, by the way, put a link to Peter's website on the Think page of KERA.org. I wonder if you can talk for a minute about what people might be doing unwittingly to contribute to the problem, even people who might be giving some of their income to solve things. Are there things about our lifestyles today that make it harder for the developing world to improve itself?
Well, certainly one thing, of course, is that increasingly we're going to see in the coming years people who've become poor because of climate change. I'm Australian, and I think of all the affluent nations in the world, Australia has been most hit by climate change because it's a dry continent, and rainfall patterns have changed over the last 10 years, and there are areas where people used to grow rice, and there's just no irrigation to do it, so there's no rice being grown. Now, the people who used to grow rice there are not starving. They can go elsewhere. They can probably find work. And if not, Australia has a social safety net that they'll be okay in a way. But you can imagine the same thing happening in sub-Saharan Africa. If rainfall patterns shift because of climate change, people are going to have nowhere to go. They will become refugees. So reducing your carbon footprint and calling on your elected representatives to have strong action to stop climate change is clearly one thing that we can do. Another thing that we can do is, you know, often we use resources which have come from countries which are ruled by dictators who deal with the mining companies or the oil companies, but just take the money that's paid and don't use it for the good of the country. So really, I see that as a kind of a using stolen goods. I mean, the dictator takes over in an armed coup, and then they say, okay, so now if you want to take oil out of my country, you have to pay me. But, you know, this ruler has no democratic right. So we should contact our oil companies and say, you know, don't buy oil if the ruler is not putting the money into the country that it's from.
Peter Singer is my guest for the hour. His book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Singer. He is professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and his new book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. His website is thelifeyoucansave.org. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next to Everett in Dallas. Hello, Everett.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I think my position would be that we are sort of artificially creating even greater number of, you know, hungry and impoverished people by supporting them in locations that can't sustain them. You know, one of my biggest concerns is that we're trying really hard to help people, and you know, we're looking at it from a good perspective, but we're ultimately contributing to the problem. We should let these people, frankly, we should let nature take its course, and populations should be based on the sustainability of the land.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, it reminded me exactly of what I read about 30 years ago when Garrett Hardin said that he had a book called, Lifeboat Earth, where he said exactly that, and he named countries that he thought were over their carrying capacity and could not sustain the populations they had. Among the countries he named was Bangladesh. Bangladesh has more people in it now than it had in the 1970s. There's been no mass famine, there have been some famines, perhaps some poverty there certainly still, but in fact it's much harder to work out the number of people a country can sustain than you might think, and often countries can sustain a larger population than you expect in better conditions. So I would say Bangladesh is in better shape today than it was 30 years ago, despite having a larger population. Now, having said that, question some of the facts that you might assume, I do agree that in the end, we need to get population and resources into balance. There's no argument about that. And some countries are growing at rates that are not going to be sustainable, even if we don't know quite how many people they can support. It's going to have to slow down. I think letting people starve is just too cruel a way of controlling population, especially given, as I was saying, that we don't really know whether a country can support its population or maybe even more than its present population. So I think we have to help them, but help them in ways that will also help them to slow their population growth. And as I was saying before, that might mean making sure that every child and every girl in particular gets education. That might mean distributing means of birth control. But I don't think it really forces us just to abandon them and say, well, you have too many people, you starve. I don't think that's right, and I don't think we could be certain enough of the figures anyway.
An email from Adrian in Colleyville asks if you would talk about the idea that lack of basic property rights can limit one's ability to use aid effectively.
Yes, I think that's true. There's been a lot of study of this, that sometimes the poor live in shanty towns where there is no clear legal title even to the little shack that they might have built, and so it's hard for them to invest in it. They might lose it at any time. They can't get the usual utilities put on. And also the incentive to be enterprising, to build up a business, will not be there if there isn't basic property rights. So I agree that this can be an important thing to do in countries to help them to get good governance and to recognize the property rights of the poor. Just, you know, parallel to this, I guess, is the whole microcredit movement, which extends very small loans, maybe as little as $20 to people, so that they can build up small businesses and get that entrepreneurial spirit working. So there are many different ways of giving aid, and we should certainly not think that aid is just a matter of handing out food or anything like that. It's essentially whatever our experience and wisdom and knowledge of the region and the area tells us is going to make the biggest difference in the long run.
We're talking to Peter Singer this hour. The new book is called The Life You Can Save. Next on the line, we have Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark. Hi, Mark. Are you with us?
Yes. My question to your guest was, although agreeing with this massive poor problem in continental Africa and, you know, Asia and, you know, Central America, like he mentioned, like, you know, there's been a study that, you know, America spends about less than 1% in, you know, foreign aid. And, you know, however you ask Americans, general Americans, and they would say, you know, as far as number-wise, United States should spend more than, you know, I mean, at least should spend 5%, although they actually don't know the, you know, dollar amount that it would come out to. But my question was, is it, like, possible, or is it some sort of, like, a number that's that would prove that, you know, how many times this foreign aid was given and how many times it actually reached the poor and needy and, I mean, didn't end up in warlords or drug lords or, you know, these dictators there. So, I mean, you know, it would encourage, people that, you know, well, the money that they're actually spending is actually going to the right person and person that actually really deserve it.
Yes, that's a good point. But I think if you give to the reputable aid organizations, the ones that maybe you've heard of, like CARE or Save the Children or Oxfam America, it's not going to go to the warlords and the drug lords. They have people on the ground in the villages making sure that the money goes to the projects where it's needed, where people are prepared to work hard. Some of them require people to put in sweat equity to, you know, build up, contribute themselves to improvements. So these organizations, I think, are an assurance that it will go there. And as I was saying, I list some of those organizations on my website, thelifeyoucansave.com. So take a look at those ones, and I think you can be highly confident that it won't be going to any warlords or drug barons.
In addition to the fact that clearly this is an immediate and pressing problem, Peter, I wonder if you can talk about why you encourage people to structure their giving starting now on a monthly or a yearly basis, as opposed to encouraging people to perhaps consider giving an equivalent amount with their estate at the end of their lives.
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One is that I do think we need to do more now. And if I tell people now to give with their estate, I hope most of your listeners are going to have long and healthy lives, and it will be a long time before that money actually comes through. So I do think that we need to start now. But I also think that an attitude of giving is actually a rich and rewarding part of people's lives. And I think people should want to see what their money is doing, should be want to know about it, should want to be in contact with the organizations that are helping, and make that really a part of your life. As one of your other callers said, you know, use your time as well. I think if you just write it into your will, you really have no contact with what you're doing, with what's happening. It isn't a part of your life. It's something you put off for after your life. And I think we really help ourselves when we give. There's lots of evidence I refer to in the book of studies that show that people who give are happier and more content with their lives and more satisfied with their lives. So I think, you know, I want people to feel that and participate in it. They'll give more and they'll get more out of giving.
An email from John in Dallas says, one thought that he has is to try and organize friends and neighbors to form a group to work together toward a goal in whatever ways the group comes up with. One of these could be an actual investment group that pools resources to make friends, to make investments, rather. The income form from which is channeled into the anti-poverty effort, sort of like creating an endowment just with sort of regular people.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I really like that. I think forming neighborhood groups that will assist, looking at some of the organizations that you might give to, pooling your research on what organizations are doing and what's effective. I think that's terrific because you get people talking about it, you have support for your giving, you end up with people feeling good about their giving and giving more, and also, very importantly, they're more informed about it. So I think the idea of putting something into a pool and making it an endowment for fighting world poverty is a great idea.
Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Ronnie. Hello, Ronnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening yesterday to you guys to your radio show, and the lady there from Zambia was saying how she believed that foreign aid was causing more harm than good. And I kind of have to agree with that. I don't think the people themselves are anywhere near lazy or anything like that and deserve to starve. But I see that it just seems like to me that If we would stop giving all of this aid to all of these governments around the world and dumping money on this problem, that sooner or later these governments would eventually just have to buckle down and start taking care of their own population. And secondly, I have to take exception with the idea of me being maybe a little less moral because I don't want to delve money into this program. I watched on 60 Minutes not too long ago where a woman was on the program and she was pregnant with number 5. She had four already. 3 had died. Number 4 was in her arms and was slowly dying. I take exception to the idea of me being less moral because I don't want to help that. Because I guess my question there is, what's less moral? Me not willing to give money to that program, or this woman continuing to have children that she knows is going to starve to death? And by the way, this woman was 20 years old, and I just don't agree with some of the things that are being said. I feel sorry for these children. I wish them nothing but the best. But, you know, in the big picture, I'm afraid, yeah, nature does have to take its course. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Peter, I know that you've heard challenges like that in the past.
Yes, I have. Look, I can understand your caller's attitude. I think this girl, 20-year-old woman who's had 5 children, I think she needs help. I think she probably did not have much of an education. It may be in her culture she had no opportunities really to control her fertility, and that's why she's in that terrible situation. And I think we need to help her, and we need to help people in that country to try to do more so that people can have choices and so that we don't have girls who are having children from their teenage years and watching them die in their arms, which I think is a terrible tragedy for anyone. If I can comment on the other point, I gather that you've had Dambisa Moyo on the program, and I know her book about aid, and I agree with many of the things she says about government aid, but I am not advocating giving money to governments that become dependent on it. And her book is not about what I'm talking about. Her book is not about non-profit agencies, voluntary agency aid. She says that explicitly, I think it's on page 7, if I remember, of her book. Let's draw that sharp line between some of the problems with government aid and World Bank aid and the great job that a lot of the nonprofit agencies are doing.
Let's go next to Daniel in Greenville. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I just wanted to call and say a guy called a little while ago, and he was wanting to know how he could help because he had a modest income and he couldn't get very much, but he felt like he wanted to do more or whatever. There's an old saying, time is money. And if you give your time, I mean, he's here in America. He could give his time to organizations here in the States that help impoverished people here in the United States, and he can be helping in the States as well as abroad by just giving time to organizations in his community and in his city. And everyone can do that. So I just wanted to say that, and that's all. And thank you, Peter, for what you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment. That's a useful suggestion.
I wonder if you could talk about whether the crisis that we're experiencing now economically in this country, at least a crisis in terms of where we felt we were before, is likely to yield people being more willing to donate their time and money as opposed to less.
I think the initial reaction of most people is to pull back, is to say, oh, what's happening with the economy? I don't feel secure anymore. I'm not sure that I can give at the moment. So I know that some organizations have experienced a drop in donations, and that's tough because, of course, the crisis is not helping elsewhere in the world. People are not buying so much. People can't sell. People are being put out of work in many developing countries. But I also think that the crisis is making people reflect on their values. I've heard that from a lot of people, some newspaper articles, a lot of people saying, well, you know, this does make me think more about what's important to me. What's important to me is my family, is my friends, my health, and living in accordance with my values, living in accordance with what really matters. And now I realize that perhaps it doesn't matter so much, you know, that I can't afford this new gadget or that, whatever it might be. I can live more simply, and I can live in accordance with my values, and maybe I'll still have a little left over for contributing to those who are still far, far worse off than I am.
Do you find, Peter, that people who initially respond to your ideas with a sort of defensiveness ultimately tend to break that down and come to a place where they can at least see the wisdom in what you're talking about?
A lot of people do. I mean, I think a lot of people react to things like your caller mentioned. They've seen a TV program about something where people are having too many children or something. Just doesn't seem to work, and they have a negative reaction. And then if they learn a little bit more about what some of the aid agencies are doing and how they can help either in that situation or in quite different situations, they do start to appreciate that this is a worthwhile thing, and some of them start to donate and support those organizations.
Peter Singer is professor of bioethics at Princeton University. You can find his website, a link on the think page of KERA.org. His new book is called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Peter, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been great talking to you and to your audience.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.